The tree faced eastwards, so Toad was called at an early hour, partly by the bright sunlight streaming in on him, partly by the exceeding coldness of his toes, which made him dream that he was at home in bed in his own handsome room with the Tudor window on a cold winter's night. And his bedclothes had got up, grumbling and protesting that they couldn't stand the cold any longer, and had run downstairs to the kitchen fire to warm themselves, and he had followed on bare feet along miles and miles of icy stone-paved passages, arguing and beseeching them to be reasonable. He would probably have been aroused much earlier had he not slept for some weeks on straw over stone flags and almost forgotten the friendly feeling of thick blankets pulled well up round the chin. Sitting up, he rubbed his eyes first and his complaining toes next, wondered for a moment where he was, looking round for familiar stone wall and little barred window. Then, with a leap of the heart, remembered everything, his escape, his flight, his pursuit. Remembered, first and best thing of all, that he was free. Free! The word and the thought alone were worth 50 blankets. He was warm from end to end as he thought of the jolly world outside, waiting eagerly for him to make his triumphal entrance, ready to serve him and play up to him, anxious to help him and to keep him company, as it always had been in days of old before misfortune fell upon him. He shook himself and combed the dry leaves out of his hair with his fingers, and, his toilet complete, marched forth into the comfortable morning sun, cold but confident, hungry but hopeful, all nervous terrors of yesterday dispelled by rest and sleep and frank and heartening sunshine. He had the world all to himself that early summer morning. The dewy woodland, as he threaded it, was solitary and still. The green fields that succeeded the trees were his own to do as he liked with. The road itself, when he reached it, in that loneliness that was everywhere, seemed like a stray dog to be looking anxiously for company. Toad, however, was looking for something that could talk and tell him clearly which way he ought to go. It is all very well when you have a light heart and a clear conscience and money in your pocket, and nobody scouring the country for you to drag you off to prison again, to follow where the road beckons and points, not caring whither. The practical Toad cared very much indeed, and he could have kicked the road for its helpless silence when every minute was of importance to him. The reserved rustic road was presently joined by a shy little brother in the shape of a canal, which took its hand and ambled along by its side in perfect confidence, but with the same tongue-tied, uncommunicative attitude towards strangers. "Bother them," said Toad to himself. "But, anyhow, one thing's clear. They must both be coming from somewhere, and going to somewhere. You can't get over that, Toad, my boy." So he marched on patiently by the water's edge. Round a bend in the canal came plodding a solitary horse, stooping forward as if in anxious thought. From rope traces attached to his collar stretched a long line, taut but dipping with his stride, the further part of it dripping pearly drops. Toad let the horse pass and stood waiting for what the fates were sending him. With a pleasant swirl of quiet water at its blunt bow, the barge slid up alongside of him, its gaily painted gunwale level with the towing path, its sole occupant a big, stout woman wearing a linen sunbonnet, one brawny arm laid along the tiller.
"A nice morning, ma'am,"
she remarked to Toad as she drew up level with him.
"I dare say it is, ma'am," responded Toad politely, as he walked along the towpath abreast of her. "I dare say it is a nice morning to them that's not in sore trouble like what I am. Here's my married daughter. She sends off to me post-haste to come to her at once. So off I comes, not knowing what may be happening or going to happen, but fearing the worst, as you will understand, ma'am, if you're a mother, too. And I've left my business to look after itself, I'm in the washing and laundering line, you must know, ma'am, and I've left my young children to look after themselves, and a more mischievous and troublesome set of young imps doesn't exist, ma'am, and I've lost all my money and lost my way, and as for what may be happening to my merry daughter, why, I don't like to think of it, ma'am.
Where might your merry daughter be living, ma'am? Asked the barge woman.
She lives near to the river, ma'am, replied Toad, close to a fine house called Toad Hall, that's somewheres hereabouts in these parts. Perhaps you may have heard of it.
Toad Hall? Why, I'm going that way myself, replied the barge woman. This canal joins the river some miles farther on, a little above Toad Hall, and then it's an easy walk. You come along in the barge with me, and I'll give you a lift.
She steered the barge close to the bank, and Toad, with many humble and grateful acknowledgments, stepped lightly on board and sat down with great satisfaction.
Toad's luck again, thought he. I always come out on top.
So you're in the washing business, ma'am,
said the barge woman politely as they glided along.
And a very good business you've got, too, I dare say, if I'm not making too free in saying so.
"'Finest business in the whole county,' said Toad airily. "'All the gentry come to me. "'Wouldn't go to anyone else if they were paid. "'They know me so well. "'You see, I understand my work thoroughly "'and attend to it all myself. "'Washing, ironing, clear-starching, "'making up gents' fine shirts for evening wear. "'Everything's done under my own eye.'
"'But surely you don't do all that work yourself, ma'am,'
"'asked the barge woman respectfully.
"'Oh, I have girls, said Toad lightly. 20 girls or thereabouts, always at work. But you know what girls are, ma'am. Nasty little hussies, that's what I call them.
So do I, too, said the barge woman with great heartiness. But I dare say you set yours to rights, the idle trollops. And are you very fond of washing?
I love it, said Toad. I simply dote on it. Never so happy as when I've got both arms in the wash-tub. But then it comes so easy to me. No trouble at all. A real pleasure, I assure you, ma'am.
What a bit of luck meeting you,
observed the barge woman thoughtfully.
A regular piece of good fortune for both of us.
Why, what do you mean?
Asked Toad nervously.
Well, look at me now,
replied the barge woman.
I like washing, too, just the same as you do. And for that matter, whether I like it or not, I have got to do all my own, naturally. Moving about it, I do. Now, my husband, he's such a fellow for shirking his work and leaving the barge to me that never a moment do I get for seeing to my own affairs. By rights, he ought to be here now, either steering or attending to the horse, though luckily the horse has enough sense to attend to himself, instead of which he's gone off with the dog to see if they can't pick up a rabbit for dinner somewhere. Says he'll catch me up at the next lock. Well, that's as may be. I don't trust him once he gets off with that dog, who's worse than he is. But meantime, how am I to get on with my washing?
Oh, never mind about the washing,
said Toad, not liking the subject.
Try and fix your mind on that rabbit, a nice, fat, young rabbit, I'll be bound. Got any onions?
I can't fix my mind on anything but my washing,
said the barge woman.
And I wonder you can be talking of rabbits with such a joyful prospect before you. There's a heap of things of mine that you'll find in a corner of the cabin. If you'll just take one or two of the most necessary sort, I won't venture to describe them to a lady like you, but you'll recognize them at a glance, and put them through the wash-tub as we go along. Why, it'll be a pleasure to you, as you rightly say, and a real help to me. You'll find a tub handy, and soap, and a kettle on the stove, and a bucket to haul up water from the canal with. Then I shall know you're enjoying yourself, instead of sitting here idle, looking at the scenery and yawning your head off.
Here, you let me steer, said Toad, now thoroughly frightened. And then you can get on with your washing your own way. I might spoil your things, or not do them as you like. I'm more used to gentlemen's things myself. It's my special line.
"'Let you steer,' replied the barge woman, laughing. "'It takes some practice to steer a barge properly. "'Besides, it's dull work, and I want you to be happy. "'No, yours shall do the washing you are so fond of, "'and I'll stick to the steering that I understand. "'Don't try and deprive me of the pleasure of giving you a treat.'
"'Toad was fairly cornered. He looked for escape this way and that, saw that he was too far from the bank for a flying leap, and sullenly resigned himself to his fate.
If it comes to that, he thought in desperation, I suppose any fool can wash.
He fetched a tub, soap, and other necessaries from the cabin, selected a few garments at random, tried to recollect what he had seen in casual glances through laundry windows, and set to. A long half hour passed, and every minute of it saw Toad getting crosser and crosser. Nothing that he could do to the things seemed to please them or do them good. He tried coaxing. He tried slapping. He tried punching. They smiled back at him out of the tub, unconverted, happy in their original sin. Once or twice he looked nervously over his shoulder at the barge woman, but she appeared to be gazing out in front of her, absorbed in her steering. His back ached badly, and he noticed with dismay that his paws were beginning to get all crinkly. Now Toad was very proud of his paws. He muttered under his breath words that should never pass the lips of either washerwomen or toads, and lost the soap for the 50th time. A burst of laughter made him straighten himself and look round. The barge woman was leaning back and laughing unrestrainedly till the tears ran down her cheeks.
I've been watching you all the time, she gasped. I thought you must be a humbug all along from the conceited way you talked. Pretty washerwoman you are. Never washed so much as a dishclout in your life, I'll lay.
Toad's temper, which had been simmering viciously for some time, now fairly boiled over, and he lost all control of himself.
You common, low-fat bargewoman, he shouted. Don't you dare to talk to your betters like that. Washerwoman, indeed. I would have you to know that I am a toad, a very well-known, respected, distinguished toad. I may be under a bit of a cloud at present, but I will not be laughed at by a bargewoman.
The woman moved nearer to him and peered under his bonnet keenly and closely.
"Why, so you are!" she cried. "Well, I never! A horrid, nasty, crawly toad! And in my nice, clean barge, too! Now that is a thing that I will not have!"
She relinquished the tiller for a moment. One big mottled arm shot out and caught Toad by a foreleg, while the other gripped him fast by a hind leg. Then the world turned suddenly upside down. The barge seemed to flit lightly across the sky. The wind whistled in his ears. And Toad found himself flying through the air, revolving rapidly as he went. The water, when he eventually reached it with a loud splash, proved quite cold enough for his taste, though its chill was not sufficient to quell his proud spirit or slake the heat of his furious temper. He rose to the surface spluttering, and when he had wiped the duckweed out of his eyes, the first thing he saw was the fat barge woman looking back at him over the stern of the retreating barge and laughing, and he vowed, as he coughed and choked, to be even with her. He struck out for the shore, but the cotton gown greatly impeded his efforts. And when at last he touched land, he found it hard to climb up the steep bank unassisted. He had to take a minute or two's rest to recover his breath. Then, gathering his wet skirts well over his arms, he started to run after the barge as fast as his legs would carry him, wild with indignation, thirsting for revenge. The barge woman was still laughing when he drew up level with her.
"Put yourself through your mangle, washerwoman," she called out, "and iron your face and crimp it, and you'll pass for quite a decent-looking toad."
Toad never paused to reply.
Solid revenge was what he wanted, not cheap, windy, verbal triumphs,
though he had a thing or two in his mind that he would have liked to say. He saw what he wanted ahead of him. Running swiftly on, he overtook the horse, unfastened the tow rope and cast off, jumped lightly on the horse's back, and urged it to a gallop by kicking it vigorously in the sides. He steered for the open country, abandoning the towpath and swinging his steed down a rutty lane. Once he looked back and saw that the barge had run aground on the other side of the canal, and the barge woman was gesticulating wildly and shouting,
"Stop! Stop! Stop!"
I've heard that song before, said Toad, laughing, as he continued to spur his steed onward in its wild career. The barge horse was not capable of any very sustained effort, and its gallop soon subsided into a trot, and its trot into an easy walk. But Toad was quite contented with this, knowing that he at any rate was moving and the barge was not. He had quite recovered his temper, now that he had done something he thought really clever, and he was satisfied to jog along quietly in the sun, taking advantage of any byways and bridle paths, and trying to forget how very long it was since he had had a square meal, till the canal had been left very far behind him. He had traveled some miles, his horse and he was feeling drowsy in the hot sunshine, when the horse stopped, lowered his head, and began to nibble the grass. And Toad, waking up, just saved himself from falling off by an effort. He looked about him and found he was on a wide common, dotted with patches of gorse and bramble as far as he could see. Near him stood a dingy gypsy caravan, and beside it a man was sitting on a bucket turned upside down, very busy smoking and staring into the wide world. A fire of sticks was burning nearby, and over the fire hung an iron pot. And out of that pot came forth bubblings and gurglings and a vague, suggestive steaminess. Also smells, warm, rich, and varied smells that twined and twisted and wreathed themselves at last into one complete, voluptuous, perfect smell that seemed like the very soul of nature taking form and appearing to her children, a true goddess, a mother of solace and comfort. Toad now knew well that he had not been really hungry before. What he had felt earlier in the day had been a mere trifling qualm. This was the real thing at last, and no mistake. And it would have to be dealt with speedily, too, or there would be trouble for somebody or something. He looked at the gypsy over carefully, wondering vaguely whether it would be easier to fight him or cajole him. So there he sat and sniffed and sniffed and looked at the gypsy. And the gypsy sat and smoked and looked at him. Presently the gypsy took his pipe out of his mouth and remarked in a careless way, "Want to sell that there horse of yours?" Toad was completely taken aback. He did not know the gypsies were very fond of horse dealing and never missed an opportunity. And he had not reflected that caravans were always on the move and took a deal of drawing. It had not occurred to him to turn the horse into cash. But the gypsy's suggestion seemed to smooth the way towards the two things he wanted so badly, ready money and a solid breakfast.
"What?" he said. "Me sell this beautiful young horse of mine? Oh, no, it's out of the question. Who's going to take the washing home to my customers every week? Besides, I'm too fond of him, and he simply dotes on me."
"Try and love a donkey," suggested the gypsy. "Some people do."
"You don't seem to see," continued Toad, "that this fine horse of mine is a cut above you altogether. He's a blood horse, he is, partly. Not the part you see, of course, another part. And he's been a prize hackney, too, in his time. That was the time before you knew him. But you can still tell it on him at a glance, if you understand anything about horses. No, it's not to be thought of for a moment. All the same, how much might you be disposed to offer me for this beautiful young horse of mine?"
The gypsy looked the horse over, and then he looked Toad over with equal care, and looked at the horse again.
"Shillin' a leg," he said briefly,
and turned away, continuing to smoke and trying to stare the wide world out of countenance.
"A shilling a leg!" cried Toad. "If you please, I must take a little time to work that out and see just what it comes to."
He climbed down off his horse and left it to graze and sat down by the gypsy and did sums on his fingers, and at last he said,
"A shilling a leg? Why, that comes to exactly 4 shillings, and no more. Oh, no, I could not think of accepting 4 shillings for this beautiful young horse of mine."
"Well," said the gypsy, "I'll tell you what I will do.
I'll make it 5 shillings, and that's 3 and 6 pence more than the animal's worth, and that's my last word. Then Toad sat and pondered long and deeply, for he was hungry and quite penniless, and still some way, he knew not how far, from home. To one in such a situation, 5 shillings may very well appear a large sum of money. On the other hand, it did not seem very much to get for a horse. But then again, the horse hadn't cost him anything, so whatever he got was all clear profit. At last he said firmly, "Look here, Gypsy, I tell you what we will do, and this is my last word. You shall hand me over 6 shillings and 6 pence, cash down, and further, in addition thereto, you shall give me as much breakfast as I can possibly eat at one sitting, of course, out of that iron pot of yours that keeps sending forth such delicious and exciting smells. In return, I will make over to you my spirited young horse with all the beautiful harness and trappings that are on him, freely thrown in. If that's not good enough for you, say so, and I'll be getting on. I know a man near here who's wanted this horse of mine for years." The gypsy grumbled frightfully, and declared if he did a few more deals of that sort he'd be ruined. But in the end he lugged a dirty canvas bag out of the depths of his trouser pocket and counted out 6 shillings and 6 pence into Toad's paw. Then he disappeared into the caravan for an instant and returned with a large iron plate and a knife, fork, and spoon. He tilted up the pot, and a glorious stream of hot, rich stew gurgled into the plate. It was indeed the most beautiful stew in the world, being made of partridges and pheasants and chickens and hares and rabbits and peahens and guinea fowls and one or two other things. Toad took the plate on his lap, almost crying, and stuffed and stuffed and kept asking for more. And the gypsy never grudged at him. He thought that he had never eaten so good a breakfast in all his life. When Toad had taken as much stew on board as he thought he could possibly hold, he got up and said goodbye to the gypsy and took an affectionate farewell of the horse. And the gypsy, who knew the riverside well, gave him directions which way to go. And he set forth on his travels again in the best possible spirits. He was indeed a very different Toad from the animal of an hour ago. The sun was shining brightly. His wet clothes were quite dry again. He had money in his pockets once more. He was nearing home and friends and safety. And most and best of all, he had had a substantial meal, hot and nourishing, and felt big and strong and careless and self-confident. As he tramped along gaily, he thought of his adventures and escapes, and how, when things seemed at their worst, he had always managed to find a way out. And his pride and conceit began to swell within him. "Ho, ho!" he said to himself as he marched along with his chin in the air. "What a clever toad I am! There is surely no animal equal to me for cleverness in the whole world! My enemies shut me up in prison, encircled by sentries, watched night and day by warders. I walk out through them all by sheer ability coupled with courage. They pursue me with engines and policemen and revolvers. I snap my fingers at them and vanish, laughing, into space. I am unfortunately thrown into a canal by a woman fat of body and very evil-minded. What of it? I swim ashore. I seize a horse. I ride off in triumph, and I sell the horse for a whole pocketful of money and an excellent breakfast. I am the toad, the handsome, the popular, the successful toad." He got so puffed up with conceit that he made up a song as he walked, in praise of himself, and sang it at the top of his voice, though there was no one to hear it but him. It was, perhaps, the most conceited song that any animal ever composed. "The world has held great heroes, as history books have showed, but never a name to go down to fame compared with that of Toad.
The clever men at Oxford know all that there is to be knowed, but they none of them know one half as much as intelligent Mr. Toad. Hey, rum-ba-ba-ba-bum! The animals sat in the ark and cried, their tears in torrents flowed. Who was it said, there's land ahead, encouraging Mr. Toad? A-rump, a-rump, a-rump. The army all saluted as they marched along the road. Was it the king or Kitchener? No, it was Mr. Toad. Rump-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-bum. The queen and her ladies in waiting sat at the window and sewed. She cried, look who's that handsome man. They answered, Mr. Toad. Ha, 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 ha.
There was a great deal more of the same sort, but too dreadfully conceited to be written down. These are some of the milder verses. He sang as he walked, and he walked as he sang, and got more inflated every minute, but his pride was shortly to have a severe fall. After some miles of country lanes, he reached the high road, and, as he turned into it and glanced along its white length, he saw approaching him a speck that turned into a dot, and then into a blob, and then into something very familiar, and a double note of warning, only too well known, fell on his delighted ear.
This is something like, said the excited Toad. This is real life again. This is once more the great world from which I have been missed so long. I will hail them, my brothers of the wheel, and pitch them a yarn of the sort that has been so successful hitherto. And they will give me a lift, of course, and then I will talk to them some more, and perhaps with luck it may even end in my driving up to Toad Hall in a motor car. That will be one in the eye for Badger.
He stepped confidently out into the road to hail the motor car, which came along at an easy pace, slowing down as it neared the lane, when suddenly he became very pale. His heart turned to water. His knees shook and yielded under him, and he doubled up and collapsed with a sickening pain in his interior. And well he might, the unhappy animal. For the approaching car was the very one he had stolen out of the yard of the Red Lion Hotel on that fatal day when all his troubles began. And the people in it were the very same people he had sat and watched at luncheon in the coffee room. He sank down in a shabby, miserable heap in the road, murmuring to himself in his despair, "It's all up. It's all over now. Chains and policemen again, prison again, dry bread and water again. Oh, what a fool I have been! What did I want to go strutting about the country for, singing conceited songs and hailing people in broad day on the high road instead of hiding till nightfall and slipping home quietly by back ways? Oh, hapless Toad! Oh, ill-fated animal!" The terrible motor car drew slowly nearer and nearer till at last he heard it stop just short of him. Two gentlemen got out and walked round the trembling heap of crumpled misery lying in the road, and one of them said,
"Oh, dear, this is very sad. Here is a poor old thing, a washerwoman apparently, who has fainted in the road. Perhaps she is overcome by the heat, poor creature, or possibly she has not had any food today. Let us lift her into the car and take her to the nearest village, where doubtless she has friends."
They tenderly lifted Toad into the motor car and propped him up with soft cushions, and proceeded on their way. When Toad heard them talk in so kind and sympathetic a manner, and knew that he was not recognized, his courage began to revive, and he cautiously opened first one eye and then the other.
"Look," said one of the gentlemen, "she is better already. The fresh air is doing her good. How do you feel now, ma'am?"
"Thank you kindly, sir," said Toad in a feeble voice. "I'm feeling a great deal better."
"That's right," said the gentleman. "Now keep quite still, and above all, don't try to talk."
"I won't," said Toad. "I was only thinking if I might sit on the front seat there beside the driver, where I could get the fresh air full in my face, I should soon be all right again."
"What a very sensible woman," said the gentleman. "Of course you shall."
So they carefully helped Toad into the front seat beside the driver, and on they went once more. Toad was almost beside himself again by now. He sat up, looked about him, and tried to beat down the tremors, the yearnings, the old cravings that rose up and beset him and took possession of him entirely.
"It is fate,"
he said to himself.
"Why strive? Why struggle?"
And he turned to the driver at his side.
"Please, sir," he said, "I wish you would kindly let me try and drive the car for a little. I've been watching you carefully, and it looks so easy and so interesting, and I should like to be able to tell my friends that once I had driven a motor car."
The driver laughed at the proposal so heartily that the gentleman inquired what the matter was. When he heard, he said, to Toad's delight,
"Bravo, ma'am! I like your spirit. Let her have a try and look after her. She won't do any harm."
Toad eagerly scrambled into the seat vacated by the driver, took the steering wheel in his hands, listened with affected humility to the instructions given him, and set the car in motion, but very slowly and carefully at first, for he was determined to be prudent. The gentlemen behind clapped their hands and applauded, and Toad heard them saying,
"How well she does it! Fancy a washerwoman driving a car as well as that, the first time!"
Toad went a little faster, then faster still, and faster he heard the gentleman call out warningly,
"Be careful, washerwoman!"
And this annoyed him, and he began to lose his head. The driver tried to interfere, but he pinned him down in his seat with one elbow and put on full speed. The rush of air in his face, the hum of the engine, and the light jump of the car beneath him intoxicated his weak brain.
"Washerwoman, indeed!" he shouted recklessly. "Ho, ho! I am the Toad, the motor car snatcher, the prison breaker, the Toad who always escapes. Sit still and you shall know what driving really is, for you are in the hands of the famous, the skillful, the entirely fearless Toad."
With a cry of horror, the whole party rose and flung themselves on him.
"Seize him," they cried. "Seize the Toad, the wicked animal who stole our motor car. Bind him, chain him, drag him to the nearest police station. Down with the desperate and dangerous Toad!"
Alas, they should have thought they ought to have been more prudent. They should have remembered to stop the motor car somehow before playing any pranks of that sort. With a half turn of the wheel, the Toad sent the car crashing through the low hedge that ran along the roadside. One mighty bound, a violent shock, and the wheels of the car were churning up the thick mud of a horse pond. Toad found himself flying through the air with a strong upward rush and delicate curve of a swallow. He liked the motion and was just beginning to wonder whether it would go on until he developed wings and turned into a toad bird when he landed on his back with a thump in the soft, rich grass of a meadow. Sitting up, he could just see the motor car in the pond, nearly submerged. The gentleman and the driver, encumbered by their long coats, were floundering helplessly in the water. He picked himself up rapidly and set off running across country as hard as he could, scrambling through hedges, jumping ditches, pounding across fields, till he was breathless and weary and had to settle down into an easy walk. When he had recovered his breath somewhat and was able to think calmly, he began to giggle, and from giggling he took to laughing. And he laughed till he had to sit down under a hedge.
"Ho, ho!" he cried in ecstasies of self-admiration. "Toad again! Toad as usual comes out on top! Who was it got them to give him a lift? Who managed to get on the front seat for the sake of fresh air? Who persuaded them into letting him see if he could drive? Who landed them all in a horse pond? Who escaped flying gaily and unscathed through the air, leaving the narrow-minded, grudging, timid excursionists in the mud, where they should rightly be? Why, Toad, of course. Clever Toad. Great Toad. Good Toad."
Then he burst into song again and chanted with uplifted voice.
"The motor car went boop, boop, boop as it raced along the road. Who was it steered it into a pond? Ingenious Mr. Toad. Oh, how clever I am. How clever, how clever, how very clever."
A slight noise at a distance behind him made him turn his head and look.
Oh, horror! Oh, misery! Oh, despair!
About two fields off, a chauffeur in his leather gaiters, and two large rural policemen were visible, running towards him as hard as they could go. Poor Toad sprang to his feet and pelted away again, his heart in his mouth.
"Oh, my," he gasped as he panted along, "what an ass I am! What a conceited and heedless ass! Swaggering again, shouting and singing songs again, sitting still and gassing again, oh my, oh my, oh my!"
He glanced back and saw to his dismay that they were gaining on him. On he ran desperately, but kept looking back and saw that they still gained steadily. He did his best, but he was a fat animal and his legs were short, and still they gained. He could hear them close behind him now. Ceasing to heed where he was going, he struggled on blindly and wildly, looking back over his shoulder at the now triumphant enemy, when suddenly the earth failed under his feet. He grasped at the air and splash! He found himself head over ears in deep water, rapid water, water that bore him along with a force he could not contend with, and he knew that in his blind panic he had run straight into the river. He rose to the surface and tried to grasp the reeds and the rushes that grew along the water's edge, close under the bank, but the stream was so strong that it tore them out of his hands.
"Oh, my," gasped poor Toad, "if ever I steal a motor car again, if ever I sing another conceited song."
Then down he went, and came up breathless and spluttering. Presently he saw that he was approaching a big, dark hole in the bank, just above his head, and as the stream bore him past, he reached up with a paw and caught hold of the edge and held on. Then, slowly and with difficulty, he drew himself up out of the water, till at last he was able to rest his elbows on the edge of the hole. There he remained for some minutes, puffing and panting, for he was quite exhausted. As he sighed and blew and stared before him into the dark hole, some bright small thing shone and twinkled in its depths, moving towards him. As it approached, a face grew up gradually around it, and it was a familiar face, brown and small, with whiskers, grave and round, with neat ears and silky hair. It was the Water Rat.
This book is continued on Disc 6. Disc 6.
Chapter 11. Like summer tempests came his tears. The rat put out a neat little brown paw, gripped Toad firmly by the scruff of the neck, and gave a great hoist and a pull. And the waterlogged Toad came up slowly but surely over the edge of the hole, till at last he stood safe and sound in the hall, streaked with mud and weed, to be sure, and with the water streaming off him, but happy and high-spirited as of old, now that he found himself once more in the house of a friend, and dodgings and evasions were over, and he could lay aside a disguise that was unworthy of his position and wanted such a lot of living up to.
"Oh, Ratty," he cried, "I've been through such times since I saw you last, you can't think. Such trials, such sufferings, and all so nobly borne. Then such escapes, such disguises, such subterfuges, and all so cleverly planned and carried out. Been in prison. Got out of it, of course. Been thrown into a canal. Swam ashore. Stole a horse. Sold him for a large sum of money. Humbugged everybody, made them all do exactly what I wanted. Oh, I am a smart Toad, and no mistake. What do you think my last exploit was? Just hold on till I tell you."
"Toad," said the Water Rat, gravely and firmly, "you go off upstairs at once, and take off that old cotton rag that looks as if it might formerly have belonged to some washerwoman, and clean yourself thoroughly, and put on some of my clothes, and try and come down looking like a gentleman, if you can. For a more shabby, bedraggled, disreputable-looking object than you are, I never set eyes on in my whole life. Now stop swaggering and arguing, and be off. I'll have something to say to you later. Toad was at first inclined to stop and do some talking back at him. He had had enough of being ordered about when he was in prison, and here was the thing being begun all over again, apparently, and by a rat, too. However, he caught sight of himself in the looking-glass over the hat-stand, with the rusty black bonnet perched rakishly over one eye, and he changed his mind and went very quickly and humbly upstairs to the rat's dressing-room. There he had a thorough wash and brush-up, changed his clothes, and stood for a long time before the glass, contemplating himself with pride and pleasure, and thinking what utter idiots all the people must have been to have ever mistaken him for one moment for a washerwoman. By the time he came down again, luncheon was on the table, and very glad Toad was to see it, for he had been through some trying experiences and had taken much hard exercise since the excellent breakfast provided for him by the gypsy. While they ate, Toad told the rat all his adventures, dwelling chiefly on his own cleverness and presence of mind in emergencies and cunning in tight places, and rather making out that he had been having a gay and highly colored experience. But the more he talked and boasted, the more grave and silent the rat became. When at last Toad had talked himself to a standstill, there was silence for a while, and then the rat said, "Now, Toady, I don't want to give you pain after all you've been through already, but seriously, don't you see what an awful ass you've been making of yourself? On your own admission, you have been handcuffed, imprisoned, starved, chased, terrified out of your life, insulted, jeered at, and ignominiously flung into the water, by a woman, too. Where's the amusement in that? Where does the fun come in? And all because you must needs go and steal a motor car. You know that you've never had anything but trouble from motor cars from the moment you first set eyes on one. But if you will be mixed up with them, as you generally are 5 minutes after you've started, why steal them? Be a cripple if you think it's exciting. Be a bankrupt for a change if you've set your mind on it. But why choose to be a convict? When are you going to be sensible and think of your friends and try and be a credit to them? Do you suppose it's any pleasure to me, for instance, to hear animals saying, as I go about, that I'm the chap that keeps company with jailbirds? Now, it was a very comforting point in Toad's character that he was a thoroughly good-hearted animal, and never minded being jawed by those who were his real friends. And even when most set upon a thing, he was always able to see the other side of the question. So although, while the rat was talking so seriously, he kept saying to himself mutinously, "But it was fun, though, awful fun," and making strange suppressed noises inside him, and boop, boop, and other sounds resembling stifled snorts or the opening of soda-water bottles, yet when the rat had quite finished, he heaved a deep sigh and said, very nicely and humbly, "Quite right, Ratty. How sound you always are. Yes, I've been a conceited old ass, I can quite see that. But now I'm going to be a good toad and not do it any more. As for motor cars, I've not been at all so keen about them since my last ducking in that river of yours. The fact is, while I was hanging under the edge of your hole and getting my breath, I had a sudden idea, a really brilliant idea, connected with motorboats. There, there, don't take on so, old chap, and stamp and upset things. It was only an idea, and we won't talk any more about it now. We'll have our coffee and a smoke and a quiet chat, and then I'm going to stroll gently down to Toad Hall and get into clothes of my own and set things going again on the old lines. I've had enough of adventures. I shall lead a quiet, steady, respectable life
pottering about my property and improving it and doing a little landscape gardening at times, there will always be a bit of dinner for my friends when they come to see me, and I shall keep a pony chaise to jog about the country in, just as I used to in the good old days, before I got restless and wanted to do things. "Stroll gently down to Toad Hall," cried the Rat, greatly excited. "What are you talking about? Do you mean to say you haven't heard?"
"Heard what?" said Toad, turning rather pale.
"Go on, Ratty, quick, don't spare me. What haven't I heard?" "Do you mean to tell me," shouted the Rat, thumping with his little fist on the table, "that you've heard nothing about the stoats and weasels?"
"What?
The wild wooders?"
cried Toad, trembling in every limb.
"No, not a word. What have they been doing? And how they've been and taken Toad Hall?" continued the Rat.
Toad leaned his elbows on the table and his chin on his paws, and a large tear welled up in each of his eyes, overflowed, and splashed on the table. Plop, plop.
"Go on, Ratty," he murmured presently. "Tell me all. The worst is over. I am an animal again. I can bear it." "When you got into that trouble of yours," said the Rat slowly and impressively, "I mean when you disappeared from society for a time over that misunderstanding about a machine, you know."
Toad merely nodded.
"Well, it was a good deal talked about down here, naturally," continued the Rat. "Not only along the riverside, but even in the wild wood. Animals took sides, as always happens. The river bankers stuck up for you and said you had been infamously treated, and there was no justice to be had in the land nowadays. But the wild wood animals said hard things and served you right, and it was time this sort of thing was stopped. And they got very cocky and went about saying you were done for this time. You would never come back again. Never, never."
Toad nodded once more, keeping silence.
"That's the sort of little beasts they are," the Rat went on. "But Mole and Badger, they stuck out through thick and thin that you would come back again soon, somehow. They didn't know exactly how, but somehow."
Toad began to sit up in his chair again and to smirk a little.
"They argued from history," continued the Rat. "They said that no criminal laws had ever been known to prevail against cheek and plausibility such as yours, combined with the power of a long purse. So they arranged to move their things into Toad Hall and sleep there and keep it aired and have it all ready for you when you turned up. They didn't guess what was going to happen, of course. Still, they had their suspicions of the wild wood animals. Now I come to the most painful and tragic part of my story. One dark night, it was a very dark night, and blowing hard, too, and raining simply cats and dogs, a band of weasels, armed to the teeth, crept silently up the carriage drive to the front entrance. Simultaneously, a body of desperate ferrets, advancing through the kitchen garden, possessed themselves of the backyard and offices, while a company of skirmishing stoats, who stuck at nothing, occupied the conservatory and the billiard room and held the French windows opening onto the lawn. The Mole and the Badger were sitting by the fire in the smoking room, telling stories and suspecting nothing, for it wasn't a night for any animals to be out in, when those bloodthirsty villains broke down the doors and rushed in upon them from every side. They made the best fight they could, but what was the good? They were unarmed and taken by surprise, and what can two animals do against hundreds? They took and beat them severely with sticks, those two poor faithful creatures, and turned them out into the cold and the wet, with many insulting and uncalled-for remarks." Here the unfeeling Toad broke into a snigger,
and then pulled himself together and tried to look particularly solemn. "And the Wild Wooders have been living in Toad Hall ever since," continued the Rat, "and going on simply anyhow, lying in bed half the day and breakfast at all hours, and the place in such a mess, I'm told, it's not fit to be seen, eating your grub and drinking your drink and making bad jokes about you and singing vulgar songs about, well, about prisons and magistrates and policemen, horrid personal songs with no humor in them. And they're telling the tradespeople and everybody that they've come to stay for good."
"Oh, have they?" said Toad, getting up and seizing a stick. "I'll jolly soon see about that."
"It's no good, Toad," called the Rat after him. "You'd better come back and sit down. You'll only get into trouble." But the Toad was off, and there was no holding him. He marched rapidly down the road, his stick over his shoulder, fuming and muttering to himself in his anger, till he got near his front gate, when suddenly there popped up from behind the palings a long yellow ferret with a gun.
"Who comes there?"
said the ferret sharply.
"Stuff and nonsense," said Toad very angrily. "What do you mean by talking like that to me? Come out of it at once, or I'll—"
The ferret said never a word, but he brought his gun up to his shoulder. Toad prudently dropped flat in the road, and bang! A bullet whistled over his head. The startled Toad scrambled to his feet and scampered off down the road as hard as he could, and as he ran he heard the ferret laughing, and other horrid, thin little laughs taking it up and carrying on the sound. He went back, very crestfallen, and told the Water Rat. "What did I tell you?" said the Rat. "It's no good. They've got sentries posted, and they are all armed. You must just wait." Still, Toad was not inclined to give in all at once, so he got out the boat and set off rowing up the river to where the garden in front of Toad Hall came down to the waterside. Arriving within sight of his old home, he rested on his oars and surveyed the land cautiously. All seemed very peaceful and deserted and quiet. He could see the whole front of Toad Hall glowing in the evening sunshine, the pigeons settling by twos and threes along the straight line of the roof, the garden a blaze of flowers, the creek that led up to the boathouse, the little wooden bridge that crossed it, all tranquil, uninhabited, apparently waiting for his return. He would try the boathouse first, he thought. Very warily, he paddled up to the mouth of the creek and was just passing under the bridge when, crash! A great stone dropped from above, smashed through the bottom of the boat. It filled and sank, and Toad found himself struggling in deep water. Looking up, he saw two stoats leaning over the parapet of the bridge and watching him with great glee.
"It will be your head next time, Toady,"
they called out to him. The indignant Toad swam to shore while the stoats laughed and laughed, supporting each other, and laughed again till they nearly had two fits. That is, one fit each, of course. The Toad retraced his weary way on foot and related his disappointing experiences to the Water Rat once more. "Well, what did I tell you?" said the Rat very crossly. "And now, look here, see what you've been and done. Lost me my boat that I was so fond of, that's what you've done, and simply ruined that nice suit of clothes that I lent you. Really, Toad, of all the trying animals, I wonder you managed to keep any friends at all." The Toad saw at once how wrongly and foolishly he had acted. He admitted his errors and wrong-headedness and made a full apology to Rat for losing his boat and spoiling his clothes. And he wound up by saying, with that frank self-surrender which always disarmed his friend's criticism and won them back to his side, "Ratty, I see that I have been a headstrong and a willful Toad. Henceforth, believe me, I will be humble and submissive and will take no action without your kind advice and full approval." "If that is really so," said the good-natured Rat, already appeased, Then my advice to you is, considering the lateness of the hour, to sit down and have your supper, which will be on the table in a minute, and be very patient. For I am convinced that we can do nothing until we have seen the mole and the badger and heard their latest news and held conference and taken their advice in this difficult matter.
Yes, of course, the mole and the badger, said Toad lightly. What's become of them, the dear fellows? I had forgotten all about them.
Well, may you ask, said the rat reproachfully. While you were riding about the country in expensive motor cars, and galloping proudly on blood horses, and breakfasting on the fat of the land, those two poor devoted animals have been camping out in the open in every sort of weather, living very rough by day, and lying very hard by night, watching over your house, patrolling your boundaries, keeping a constant eye on the stoats and weasels, scheming and planning and contriving how to get your property back for you. You don't deserve to have such true and loyal friends, Toad. You don't, really. Some day, when it's too late, you'll be sorry you didn't value them more while you had them.
I'm an ungrateful beast, I know, sobbed Toad, shedding bitter tears. Let me go out and find them, out into the cold, dark night, and share their hardships and try and prove by...
Hold on a bit. Surely I heard the chink of dishes on a tray. Supper's here at last. Hooray! Come on, Ratty!
The rat remembered that poor Toad had been on prison fare for a considerable time, and that large allowances had therefore to be made. He followed him to the table accordingly, and hospitably encouraged him in his gallant efforts to make up for past privations. They had just finished their meal and resumed their armchairs when there came a heavy knock at the door. Toad was nervous, but the rat, nodding mysteriously at him, went straight up to the door and opened it, and in walked Mr. Badger. He had all the appearance of one who for some nights had been kept away from home and all its little comforts and conveniences. His shoes were covered with mud, and he was looking very rough and tousled. But then he had never been a very smart man, the Badger, at the best of times. He came solemnly up to Toad, shook him by the paw, and said,
"Welcome home, Toad. Alas, what am I saying? Home, indeed. This is a poor homecoming. Unhappy Toad."
Then he turned his back on him, sat down to the table, drew his chair up, and helped himself to a large slice of cold pie. Toad was quite alarmed at this very serious and portentous style of greeting, but the rat whispered to him,
"Never mind, don't take any notice, and don't say anything to him just yet. He's always rather low and despondent when he's wanting his victuals. In half an hour's time he'll be quite a different animal."
So they waited in silence, and presently there came another and a lighter knock. The rat, with a nod to Toad, went to the door and ushered in the mole. Very shabby and unwashed, with bits of hay and straw sticking in his fur.
"Hooray! Here's old Toad!" cried the mole, his face beaming. "Fancy having you back again!" And he began to dance round him. "We never dreamt you would turn up so soon. Why, you must have managed to escape, you clever, ingenious, intelligent Toad!"
The rat, alarmed, pulled him by the elbow, but it was too late. Toad was puffing and swelling already.
"Clever? Oh, no," he said. "I'm not really clever, according to my friends. I've only broken out of the strongest prison in England, that's all, and captured a railway train and escaped on it, that's all, and disguised myself and gone about the country humbugging everybody, that's all. Oh, no, I'm a stupid ass, I am. I'll tell you one or two of my little adventures, Mole, and you shall judge for yourself."
"Well, well," said the Mole, moving towards the supper table. "Supposing you talk while I eat. Not a bite since breakfast. Oh, my, oh, my." And he sat down and helped himself liberally to cold beef and pickles.
Toad straddled on the hearthrug, thrust his paw into his trouser pocket, and pulled out a handful of silver.
Look at that," he cried, displaying it. "That's not so bad, is it, for a few minutes' work? And how do you think I done it, Mole? Horse dealing. That's how I done it."
"Go on, Toad," said the Mole, immensely interested.
"Toad, do be quiet, please," said the Rat. "And don't you egg him on, Mole, when you know what he is. But please tell us as soon as possible what the position is, and what's best to be done now that Toad is back at last."